This evidence would establish a conspiracy to violate the foreign contributions ban in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 371, the solicitation of an illegal foreign source contribution, or the acceptance or receipt of an express or implied promise to make a foreign source contribution, both in violation of 52 U.S.C. Section 30121A1A, A2. There are reasonable arguments that the offered information would constitute a thing of value within the meaning of these provisions, but the office determined that the government would not be likely to obtain and sustain a conviction for two other reasons. First, the office did not obtain admissible evidence likely to meet the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these individuals acted willfully, i.e., with general knowledge of the illegality of their conduct. And second, the government would likely encounter difficulty in proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the value of the promised information exceeded the threshold for a criminal violation. See 52 U.S.C., Section 30109D1A1. 1. Thing of value element. A threshold legal question is whether providing to a campaign documents and information of the type involved here would constitute a prohibited campaign contribution. The foreign contribution ban is not limited to contributions of money. It expressly prohibits a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value. 52 U.S.C. Section 30121A1A, A2. Emphasis added. And the term contribution is defined throughout the campaign finance laws to include any gift, subscription, loan, advance, or deposit of money or anything of value. 52 U.S.C. Section 30101-8A1. Emphasis added. The phrases thing of value and anything of value are broad and inclusive enough to encompass at least some forms of valuable information. Throughout the United States Code, these phrases serve as terms of art that are construed broadly. United States v. Nielsen, 967 F2nd, 539-542, 11th Circuit, 1992, per curiam. Thing of value includes both tangibles and intangibles. See also, e.g., 18 U.S.C., Sections 201b1, 666a2, Bribery Statutes, id, Section 641, Theft of Government Property. For example, the term thing of value encompasses law enforcement reports that would reveal the identity of informants. United States v. Girard, 601 F2nd, 6971, 2nd Circuit, 1979. Classified Materials, United States v. Fowler, 932 F2nd, 306, 310, 4th Circuit, 1991. Confidential Information About a Competitive Bid, United States v. Motzkin, 14 F3rd, 1014, 1020, 4th Circuit, 1994. Secret Grand Jury Information, United States v. Jeter, 775 F2nd, 670, 680, 6th Circuit, 1985. And Information About a Witness's Whereabouts, United States v. Shaker, 618 F2nd, 607, 609, 9th Circuit, 1980, per curiam. And in the public corruption context, thing of value is defined broadly to include the value which the defendant subjectively attaches to the items received. United States v. Renzi, 769 F3rd, 731, 744, 9th Circuit, 2014, internal quotation marks omitted. Federal Election Commission, FEC, regulations recognize the value to a campaign of at least some forms of information, stating that the term anything of value includes the provision of any goods or services without charge, such as membership lists and mailing lists. 11 CFR, Section 100.52(d)(1). The FEC has concluded that the phrase includes a state-by-state list of activists. See Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington v. FEC, 475 F3rd, 337, 338, D.C. Circuit, 2007, describing the FEC's findings. Likewise, polling data provided to a campaign constitutes a contribution. FEC Advisory Opinion 1990-12, Strub, 1990 W.L. 153454, citing 11 CFR Section 106.4b. And in the specific context of the foreign contributions ban, the FEC has concluded that election materials used in previous Canadian campaigns, including flyers, advertisements, door hangers, trifolds, signs, and other printed material, constitute anything of value, even though the value of these materials may be nominal or difficult to ascertain. FEC Advisory Opinion 2007-22, Hurris, 2007 W.L. 517-2375, at Note 5. These authorities would support the view that candidate-related opposition research given to a campaign for the purpose of influencing an election could constitute a contribution to which the foreign source ban could apply. A campaign can be assisted not only by the provision of funds, but also by the provision of derogatory information about an opponent. Political campaigns frequently conduct and pay for opposition research. A foreign entity that engaged in such research and provided resulting information to a campaign could exert a greater effect on an election and a greater tendency to ingratiate the donor to the candidate than a gift of money or tangible things of value. At the same time, no judicial decision has treated the voluntary provision of uncompensated opposition research or similar information as a thing of value that could amount to a contribution under campaign finance law. Such an interpretation could have implications beyond the foreign source ban. See 52 U.S.C., Section 30116A, imposing monetary limits on campaign contributions, and raise First Amendment questions. Those questions could be especially difficult where the information consisted simply of the recounting of historically accurate facts. It is uncertain how courts would resolve those issues. 2. Willfulness. Even assuming that the promised documents and information that would incriminate Hillary constitute a thing of value under campaign finance law, the government would encounter other challenges in seeking to obtain and sustain a conviction. Most significantly, the government has not obtained admissible evidence that is likely to establish a scienter requirement beyond a reasonable doubt. To prove that a defendant acted knowingly and willfully, the government would have to show that the defendant had general knowledge that his conduct was unlawful. U.S. Department of Justice Federal Prosecution of Election Offenses 123, 8th edition, December 2017, Election Offenses. See Blumen, 800 F. Supp. 2nd, at 292, noting that a willful violation requires proof of the defendant's knowledge of the law. Daniel Check, 917 F. Supp. 2nd, at 577, knowledge of general unlawfulness. This standard creates an elevated scienter element, requiring at the very least that application of the law to the facts in question be fairly clear. When there is substantial doubt concerning whether the law applies to the facts of a particular matter, the offender is more likely to have an intent defense. Election Offenses, 123. On the facts here, the government would unlikely be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the June 9th meeting participants had general knowledge that their conduct was unlawful. The investigation has not developed evidence that the participants in the meeting were familiar with the foreign contribution ban or the application of federal law to the relevant factual context. The government does not have strong evidence of surreptitious behavior or efforts at concealment at the time of the June 9th meeting. While the government has evidence of later efforts to prevent disclosure of the nature of the June 9th meeting that could circumstantially provide support for a show of scienter, see Volume 2, Section 2G, Infra, that concealment occurred more than a year later, involved individuals who did not attend the June 9th meeting, and may reflect an intention to avoid political consequences rather than any prior knowledge of illegality. Additionally, in light of the unresolved legal questions about whether giving documents and information of the sort offered here constitutes a campaign contribution, Trump Jr. could mount a factual defense that he did not believe his response to the offer and the June 9th meeting itself violated the law. Given his less direct involvement in arranging the June 9th meeting, Kushner could likely mount a similar defense. And while Manafort is experienced with political campaigns, the office has not developed evidence showing that he had relevant knowledge of these legal issues. 3. Difficulties in valuing promised information. The office would also encounter difficulty proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the value of the promised documents and information exceeds the $2,000 threshold for a criminal violation, as well as the $25,000 threshold for felony punishment. See 52 U.S.C. Section 30109(d)(1). The type of evidence commonly used to establish the value of non-monetary contributions, such as pricing the contribution on a commercial market or determining the upstream acquisition cost or the cost of distribution, would likely be unavailable or ineffective in this factual setting. Although damaging opposition research is surely valuable to a campaign, it appears that the information ultimately delivered in the meeting was not valuable. And while value in a conspiracy may well be measured by what the participants expected to receive at the time of the agreement, see, e.g., United States v. Tombrello, 666 F. 2nd, 485, 489, 11th Circuit, 1982, Goldstone's description of the offered material here was quite general. His suggestion of the information's value, i.e., that it would incriminate Hillary and would be very useful to Trump Jr.'s father, was non-specific and may have been understood as being of uncertain worth or reliability, given Goldstone's lack of direct access to the original source. The uncertainty over what would be delivered could be reflected in Trump Jr.'s response, "If it's what you say, I love it," emphasis added. Accordingly, taking into account the high burden to establish a culpable mental state in a campaign finance prosecution and the difficulty in establishing the required valuation, the office decided not to pursue criminal campaign finance charges against Trump Jr. or other campaign officials for the events culminating in the June 9th meeting. C. Application to redaction. Harm to ongoing matter. I. Questions over whether redaction, harm to ongoing matter. Page 189. 2. Willfulness. As discussed, to establish a criminal campaign finance violation, the government must prove that the defendant acted knowingly and willfully. 52 U.S.C. Section 30109(d)(1)(a)(1). That standard requires proof that the defendant knew generally that his conduct was unlawful. Election offenses, 123. Given the uncertainties noted above, the willfulness requirement would pose a substantial barrier to prosecution. 3. Constitutional considerations. Finally, the First Amendment could pose constraints on a prosecution. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter. 4. Analysis as to redaction, harm to ongoing matter, page 190 to 191. 4. False statements and obstruction of the investigation. The office determined that certain individuals associated with the campaign lied to investigators about campaign contacts with Russia and have taken other actions to interfere with the investigation. As explained below, the office therefore charged some U.S. persons connected to the campaign with false statements and obstruction offenses. 4A. Overview of governing law. False statements. The principal federal statute criminalizing false statements to government investigators is 18 U.S.C. Section 1001. As relevant here, under Section 1001A2, it is a crime to knowingly and willfully make any materially false, fictitious, or fraudulent statement or representation in any manner within the jurisdiction of the executive branch of the government. An FBI investigation is a matter within the executive branch's jurisdiction. United States v. Rogers, 466 U.S., 475, 479, 1984. The statute also applies to a subset of legislative branch actions, viz. Administrative matters and investigations or reviews conducted by a congressional committee or subcommittee. 18 U.S.C., Section 1001 C1 and 2. C. United States v. Pickett, 353 F3rd, 6266, D.C. Circuit, 2004. Whether the statement was made to law enforcement or congressional investigators, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the same basic non-jurisdictional elements. The statement was false, fictitious, or fraudulent. The defendant knew both that it was false and that it was unlawful to make a false statement, and the false statement was material. C. E.G. United States v. Smith, 831 F3rd, 1207, 1222, Note 27, Ninth Circuit, 2017. Listing elements. See also Ninth Circuit Pattern Instruction, 8.73, and CMT, explaining that the Section 1001 jury instruction was modified in light of the Department of Justice's position that the phrase knowingly and willfully in the statute requires the defendant's knowledge that his or her conduct was unlawful. In the D.C. Circuit, the government must prove that the statement was actually false. A statement that is misleading but literally true does not satisfy Section 1000A2. See United States v. Milton, 8 F3rd 39 45, D.C. Circuit, 1993. United States v. Dale, 991 F2nd, 819, 832 through 833, and Note 22, D.C. Circuit, 1993. For that false statement to qualify as material, it must have a natural tendency to influence or be capable of influencing a discrete decision or any other function of the agency to which it is addressed. See United States v. Godin, 515 U.S., 506, 509, 1995. United States v. Moore, 612 F3rd, 698, 701, D.C. Circuit, 2010. Perjury. Under the federal perjury statutes, it is a crime for a witness testifying under oath before a grand jury to knowingly make any false material declaration. See 18 U.S.C., Section 1623. The government must prove four elements beyond a reasonable doubt to obtain a conviction under Section 1623A. The defendant testified under oath before a federal grand jury. The defendant's testimony was false in one or more respects. The false testimony concerned matters that were material to the grand jury investigation, and the false testimony was knowingly given. United States v. Bridges, 717 F2nd, 1444, 1449, Note 30, D.C. Circuit, 1983. The general perjury statute 18 U.S.C. Section 1621, also applies to grand jury testimony and has similar elements, except that it requires that the witness have acted willfully and that the government satisfy strict common law requirements for establishing falsity. See Dunn v. United States, 442 U.S. 100, 106 and Note 6, 1979, explaining the two-witness rule and the corroboration that it demands. Obstruction of justice. Three basic elements are common to the obstruction statutes pertinent to this office's charging decisions. An obstructive act, some form of nexus between the obstructive act and an official proceeding, and criminal, i.e., corrupt intent. A detailed discussion of those elements and the law governing obstruction of justice more generally is included in Volume 2 of the report. B. Application to certain individuals. 1. George Papadopoulos. Investigators approached Papadopoulos for an interview based on his role as a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign and his suggestion to a foreign government representative that Russia had indicated that it could assist the campaign through the anonymous release of information damaging to candidate Clinton. On January 27, 2017, Papadopoulos agreed to be interviewed by FBI agents, who informed him that the interview was part of the investigation into potential Russian government interference in the 2016 presidential election. During the interview, Papadopoulos lied about the timing, extent, and nature of his communications with Joseph Mifsud, Olga Polinskaya, and Ivan Timofeyev. With respect to timing, Papadopoulos acknowledged that he had met Mifsud and that Mifsud told him the Russians had dirt on Clinton in the form of thousands of emails. But Papadopoulos stated multiple times that those communications occurred before he joined the Trump campaign and that it was a very strange coincidence to be told of the dirt before he started working for the campaign. This account was false. Papadopoulos met Mifsud for the first time on approximately March 14, 2016, after Papadopoulos had already learned he would be a foreign policy advisor for the campaign. Mifsud showed interest in Papadopoulos only after learning of his role on the campaign. And Mifsud told Papadopoulos about the Russians possessing dirt on candidate Clinton in late April 2016, more than a month after Papadopoulos had joined the campaign and been publicly announced by candidate Trump. Statement of Offense. Paragraphs 25 through 26. United States v. George Papadopoulos, number 1, 17 CR 182, DDC October 5, 2017, Document 19. Papadopoulos' Statement of Offense. Papadopoulos also made false statements in an effort to minimize the extent and importance of his communications with Mifsud. For example, Papadopoulos stated that Mifsud's a nothing, that he thought Mifsud was just a guy talking up connections or something, and that he believed Mifsud was BSing, to be completely honest with you. In fact, however, Papadopoulos understood Mifsud to have substantial connections to high-level Russian government officials, and that Mifsud spoke with some of those officials in Moscow before telling Papadopoulos about the dirt. Papadopoulos also engaged in extensive communications over a period of months with Mifsud about foreign policy issues for the campaign, including efforts to arrange a history-making meeting between the campaign and Russian government officials. In addition, Papadopoulos failed to inform investigators that Mifsud had introduced him to Timofeyev, the Russian national who Papadopoulos understood to be connected to the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, despite being asked if he had met with Russian nationals or anyone with a Russian accent during the campaign. Papadopoulos' Statement of Offense, paragraphs 27 through 29. Papadopoulos also falsely claimed that he met Polonskaya before he joined the campaign, and falsely told the FBI that he had no relationship at all with her. He stated that the extent of their communications was her sending emails, just, "Hi, how are you?" That's it. In truth, however, Papadopoulos met Polonskaya on March 24, 2016, after he had joined the campaign. He believed that she had connections to high-level Russian government officials and could help him arrange a potential foreign policy trip to Russia. During the campaign, he emailed and spoke with her over Skype on numerous occasions about the potential foreign policy trip to Russia. Papadopoulos' Statement of Offense, paragraphs 30 through 31. Papadopoulos' false statements in January 2017 impeded the FBI's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Most immediately, those statements hindered investigators' ability to effectively question Mifsud when he was interviewed in the lobby of a Washington, D.C. hotel on February 10, 2017. See Government Sent Memo at 6, United States v. George Papadopoulos, No. 1, 17, CR 182, DDC August 18, 2017, Document 44. During that interview, Mifsud admitted to knowing Papadopoulos and to having introduced him to Polonskaya and Timofeyev. But Mifsud denied that he had advanced knowledge that Russia was in possession of emails damaging to candidate Clinton, stating that he and Papadopoulos had discussed cybersecurity and hacking as a larger issue, and that Papadopoulos must have misunderstood their conversation. Mifsud also falsely stated that he had not seen Papadopoulos since the meeting at which Mifsud introduced him to Polonskaya, even though emails, text messages, and other information show that Mifsud met with Papadopoulos on at least two other occasions, April 12th and April 26th, 2016. In addition, Mifsud omitted that he had drafted or edited the follow-up message that Polonskaya sent to Papadopoulos following the initial meeting, and that, as reflected in the language of that email chain, "Baby, thank you," Mifsud may have been involved in a personal relationship with Polonskaya at the time. The false information and omissions in Papadopoulos' January 2017 interview undermined investigators' ability to challenge Mifsud when he made these inaccurate statements. Given the seriousness of the lies and omissions and their effect on the FBI's investigation, the office charged Papadopoulos with making false statements to the FBI in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1001. Information, United States v. George Papadopoulos, No. 1, 17 CR 182, DDC October 3, 2017, Document 8. On October 7, 2017, Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to that charge pursuant to a plea agreement. On September 7, 2018, he was sentenced to 14 days of imprisonment, a $9,500 fine, and 200 hours of community service. 2. Redaction, personal privacy. Redaction, grand jury. 3. Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn agreed to be interviewed by the FBI on January 24, 2017, 4 days after he had officially assumed his duties as National Security Advisor to the President. During the interview, Flynn made several false statements pertaining to his communications with the Russian ambassador. First, Flynn made two false statements about his conversations with Russian Ambassador Kislyak in late December 2016, at a time when the United States had imposed sanctions on Russia for interfering with the 2016 presidential election, and Russia was considering its response. See Flynn's Statement of Offense. Flynn told the agents that he did not ask Kislyak to refrain from escalating the situation in response to the United States' imposition of sanctions. That statement was false. On December 29, 2016, Flynn called Kislyak to request Russian restraint. Flynn made the call immediately after speaking to a senior transition team official, K.T. McFarland, about what to communicate to Kislyak. Flynn then spoke with McFarland again after the Kislyak call to report on the substance of that conversation. Flynn also falsely told the FBI that he did not remember a follow-up conversation in which Kislyak stated that Russia had chosen to moderate its response to the U.S. sanctions as a result of Flynn's request. On December 31, 2016, Flynn, in fact, had such a conversation with Kislyak, and he again spoke with McFarland within hours of the call to relay the substance of his conversation with Kislyak. See Flynn's Statement of Offense, paragraph 3. Second, Flynn made false statements about calls he had previously made to representatives of Russia and other countries regarding a resolution submitted by Egypt to the United Nations Security Council on December 21, 2016. Specifically, Flynn stated that he only asked the country's positions on how they would vote on the resolution, and that he did not request that any of the countries take any particular action on the resolution. That statement was false. On December 22, 2016, Flynn called Kislyak, informed him of the upcoming Trump administration's opposition to the resolution, and requested that Russia vote against or delay the resolution. Flynn also falsely stated that Kislyak never described Russia's response to his December 22 request regarding the resolution. Kislyak, in fact, told Flynn in a conversation on December 23, 2016, that Russia would not vote against the resolution if it came to a vote. See Flynn, Statement of Offense, paragraph 4. Flynn made these false statements to the FBI at a time when he was serving as National Security Advisor and when the FBI had an open investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, including the nature of any links between the Trump campaign and Russia. Flynn's false statements and omissions impeded and otherwise had a material impact on that ongoing investigation. Flynn's Statement of Offense, paragraphs 1 through 2. They also came shortly before Flynn made separate submissions to the Department of Justice, pursuant to FARA, that also contained materially false statements and omissions. Id, paragraph 5. Based on the totality of that conduct, the office decided to charge Flynn with making false statements to the FBI in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1001A. On December 1, 2017, and pursuant to a plea agreement, Flynn pleaded guilty to that charge and also admitted his false statements to the department in his FARA filing. See Id, plea agreement, United States v. Michael T. Flynn, No. 1, 17 CR-232, DDC, December 1, 2017, Document 3. Flynn is awaiting sentencing. 4. Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen was the executive vice president and special counsel to the Trump Organization when Trump was president of the Trump Organization. Information, paragraph 1. United States v. Cohen, No. 1, 18 CR-850, SDNY, November 29, 2018, Document 2. Cohen Information. From the fall of 2015 through approximately June 2016, Cohen was involved in a project to build a Trump-branded tower and adjoining development in Moscow. The project was known as Trump Tower Moscow. In 2017, Cohen was called to testify before the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, HPSCI, and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, SSCI, both of which were investigating Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election and possible links between Russia and the presidential campaigns. In late August 2017, in advance of his testimony, Cohen caused a two-page statement to be sent to SSCI and HPSCI addressing Trump Tower Moscow. Cohen Information, paragraphs 2 through 3. The letter contained three representations relevant here. First, Cohen stated that the Trump Moscow project had ended in January 2016 and that he had briefed candidate Trump on the project only three times before making the unilateral decision to terminate it. Second, Cohen represented that he never agreed to travel to Russia in connection with the project and never considered asking Trump to travel for the project. Third, Cohen stated that he did not recall any Russian government contact about the project, including any response to an email that he had sent to a Russian government email account. Cohen information, paragraph 4. Cohen later asked that his two-page statement be incorporated into his testimony's transcript before SSCI, and he ultimately gave testimony to SSCI that was consistent with that statement. Cohen information, paragraph 5. Each of the foregoing representations in Cohen's two-page statement was false and misleading. Consideration of the project had extended through approximately June 2016 and included more than three progress reports from Cohen to Trump. Cohen had discussed with Felix Sater his own travel to Russia as part of the project, and he had inquired about the possibility of Trump traveling there, both with the candidate himself and with senior campaign official Corey Lewandowski. Cohen did recall that he had received a response to the email that he sent to Russian government spokesman Dmitry Peskov. In particular, that he received an email reply and had a follow-up phone conversation with an English-speaking assistant to Peskov in mid-January 2016. Cohen information, paragraph 7. Cohen knew the statements in the letter to be false at the time and admitted that he made them in an effort, one, to minimize the links between the project and Trump, who by this time was president, and two, to give the false impression that the project had ended before the first vote in the Republican Party primary process, in the hopes of limiting the ongoing Russia investigations. Id. Given the nature of the false statements and the fact that he repeated them during his initial interview with the office, we charged Cohen with violating Section 1001. On November 29, 2018, Cohen pleaded guilty pursuant to a plea agreement to a single-count information charging him with making false statements in a manner within the jurisdiction of the legislative branch in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1001A2 and C. Cohen information. The case was transferred to the district judge presiding over the separate prosecution of Cohen pursuant to the Southern District of New York after a referral from our office. On December 7, 2018, this office submitted a letter to that judge recommending that Cohen's cooperation with our investigation be taken into account in sentencing Cohen on both the false statements charge and the offenses in the Southern District prosecution. On December 12, 2018, the judge sentenced Cohen to 2 months of imprisonment on the false statements count to run concurrently with a 36-month sentence imposed on the other counts. 5. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter, from page 196 through 197. 6. Jeff Sessions. As set forth in Volume 1, Section 4A6, Supra, the investigation established that while a U.S. senator and a Trump campaign advisor, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions interacted with Russian Ambassador Kislyak during the week of the Republican National Convention in July 2016 and again at a meeting in Sessions' Senate office in September 2016. The investigation also established that Sessions and Kislyak both attended a reception held before candidate Trump's foreign policy speech at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. in April 2016, and that it is possible that they met briefly at that reception. The office considered whether, in light of these interactions, Sessions committed perjury before or made false statements to Congress in connection with his confirmation as Attorney General. In January 2017 testimony during his confirmation hearing, Sessions stated in response to a question about Trump campaign communications with the Russian government that he had been called a surrogate at a time or two in that campaign, and I didn't have did not have communications with the Russians. In written responses submitted on January 17, 2017, Sessions answered no to a question asking whether he had been in contact with anyone connected to any part of the Russian government about the 2016 election, either before or after Election Day. And in a March 2017 supplement to his testimony, Sessions identified two of the campaign period contacts with Ambassador Kislyak noted above, which had been reported in the media following the January 2017 confirmation hearing. Sessions stated in the supplemental response that he did not recall any discussions with the Russian ambassador or any other representatives of the Russian government regarding the political campaign on these occasions or any other occasion. Although the investigation established that Sessions interacted with Kislyak on the occasions described above, and that Kislyak mentioned the presidential campaign on at least one occasion, the evidence is not sufficient to prove that Sessions gave knowingly false answers to Russia-related questions in light of the wording and context of those questions. With respect to Sessions' statements that he did not recall any discussions with the Russian ambassador regarding the political campaign, and he had not been in contact with any Russian official about the 2016 election, the evidence concerning the nature of Sessions' interactions with Kislyak makes it plausible that Sessions did not recall discussing the campaign with Kislyak at the time of his statements. Similarly, while Sessions stated in his January 2017 oral testimony that he did not have communications with Russians, he did so in response to a question that had linked such communications to an alleged continuing exchange of information between the Trump campaign and Russian government intermediaries. Sessions later explained to the Senate and to the office that he understood the question as narrowly calling for disclosure of interactions with Russians that involved the exchange of campaign information, as distinguished from more routine contacts with Russian nationals. Given the context in which the question was asked, that understanding is plausible. Accordingly, the office concluded that the evidence was insufficient to prove that Sessions was willfully untruthful in his answers, and thus insufficient to obtain or sustain a conviction for perjury or false statements. Consistent with the principles of federal prosecution, the office therefore determined not to pursue charges against Sessions and informed his counsel of that decision in March 2018. 7. Others interviewed during the investigation. The office considered whether, during the course of the investigation, other individuals interviewed either omitted material information or provided information determined to be false. Applying the principles of federal prosecution, the office did not seek criminal charges against any individuals other than those listed above. In some instances, that decision was due to evidentiary hurdles to proving falsity. In others, the office determined that the witness ultimately provided truthful information and that considerations of culpability, deterrence, and resource preservation weighed against prosecution. See Justice Manual, Sections 927.220, 927.230. Redacted, Personal Privacy. Redacted Grand Jury, Redacted Personal Privacy, Redacted Grand Jury, Redacted Personal Privacy, Redacted Grand Jury, Redacted Personal Privacy.
Report on the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Volume 2 of 2. Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III. Submitted pursuant to 28 CFR, Section 600.8C, Washington, D.C., March 2019.
Introduction to Volume 2. This report is submitted to the Attorney General pursuant to 28 CFR section 600.8C, which states that at the conclusion of the special counsel's work, he shall provide the Attorney General a confidential report explaining the prosecution or declination decisions the special counsel reached. Beginning in 2017, the President of the United States took a variety of actions towards the ongoing FBI investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election and related matters that raised questions about whether he had obstructed justice. The order appointing the special counsel gave this office jurisdiction to investigate matters that arose directly from the FBI's Russia investigation, including whether the president had obstructed justice in connection with Russia-related investigations. The special counsel's jurisdiction also covered potentially obstructive acts related to the special counsel's investigation itself. This volume of our report summarizes our obstruction of justice investigation of the president. We first describe the considerations that guided our obstruction of justice investigation and then provide an overview of this volume. First, a traditional prosecution or declination decision entails a binary determination to initiate or decline a prosecution. But we determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment. The Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, has issued an opinion finding that the indictment or criminal prosecution of a sitting president would impermissibly undermine the capacity of the executive branch to perform its constitutionally assigned functions in violation of the constitutional separation of powers, footnote 1. Given the role of the special counsel as an attorney in the Department of Justice and the framework of the special counsel regulations, see 28 U.S.C. section 515, 28 CFR section 600.7a, this office accepted OLC's legal conclusion for the purpose of exercising prosecutorial jurisdiction. And apart from OLC's constitutional view, we recognized that a federal criminal accusation against a sitting president would place burdens on the president's capacity to govern and potentially preempt constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct, footnote 2. Second, while the OLC opinion concludes that a sitting president may not be prosecuted, it recognizes that a criminal investigation during the president's term is permissible, footnote 3. The OLC opinion also recognizes that a president does not have immunity after he leaves office, footnote 4. And if individuals other than the president committed an obstruction offense, they may be prosecuted at this time. Given those considerations, the facts known to us, and the strong public interest in safeguarding the integrity of the criminal justice system, we conducted a thorough factual investigation in order to preserve the evidence when memories were fresh and documentary materials were available. Third, we considered whether to evaluate the conduct we investigated under the Justice Manual standards governing prosecution and declination decisions. But we determined not to apply an approach that could potentially result in a judgment that the president committed crimes. The threshold step under the Justice Manual standards is to assess whether a person's conduct, quote, constitutes a federal offense, unquote. U.S. Department of Justice, Justice Manual, Section 9-27.220, 2018, Justice Manual. Fairness concerns counseled against potentially reaching that judgment when no charges can be brought. The ordinary means for an individual to respond to an accusation is through a speedy and public trial, with all the procedural protections that surround a criminal case. An individual who believes he was wrongly accused can use that process to seek to clear his name. In contrast, a prosecutor's judgment that crimes were committed, but that no charges will be brought, affords no such adversarial opportunity for public name clearing before an impartial adjudicator. footnote 5. The concerns about the fairness of such a determination would be heightened in the case of a sitting president, where a federal prosecutor's accusation of a crime, even in an internal report, could carry consequences that extend beyond the realm of criminal justice. OLC noted similar concerns about sealed indictments. Even if an indictment were sealed during the president's term, OLC reasoned, it would be very difficult to preserve an indictment's secrecy, and if an indictment became public, the stigma and opprobrium could imperil the president's ability to govern. Although a prosecutor's internal report would not represent a formal public accusation akin to an indictment, the possibility of the report's public disclosure and the absence of a neutral adjudicatory forum to review its findings counseled against potentially determining, quote, that the person's conduct constitutes a federal offense, unquote. Justice Manual, Section 9-27.220. Fourth, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, however, we are unable to reach that judgment. The evidence we obtained about the president's actions and intent presents difficult issues that prevent us from conclusively determining that no criminal conduct occurred. Accordingly, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. This report on our investigation consists of four parts. Section 1 provides an overview of obstruction of justice principles and summarizes certain investigatory and evidentiary considerations. Section 2 sets forth the factual results of our obstruction investigation and analyzes the evidence. Section 3 addresses statutory and constitutional defenses. Section 4 states our conclusion. Executive Summary to Volume 2. Our obstruction of justice inquiry focused on a series of actions by the president that related to the Russian interference investigations, including the president's conduct towards the law enforcement officials overseeing the investigations and the witnesses to relevant events. Factual results of the obstruction investigation. The key issues and events we examined include the following. The campaign's response to reports about Russian support for Trump. During the 2016 presidential campaign, questions arose about the Russian government's apparent support for candidate Trump. After WikiLeaks released politically damaging Democratic Party emails that were reported to have been hacked by Russia, Trump publicly expressed skepticism that Russia was responsible for the hacks, at the same time that he and other campaign officials privately sought information, redaction, harm to ongoing matter, about any further planned WikiLeaks releases. Trump also denied having any business in or connections to Russia, even though as late as June 2016, the Trump Organization had been pursuing a licensing deal for a skyscraper to be built in Russia called Trump Tower Moscow. After the election, the president expressed concerns to advisers that reports of Russia's election interference might lead the public to question the legitimacy of his election. Conduct involving FBI Director Comey and Michael Flynn. In mid-January 2017, incoming National Security Advisor Michael Flynn falsely denied to the vice president, other administration officials, and FBI agents that he had talked to Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak about Russia's response to U.S. sanctions on Russia for its election interference. On January 27th, the day after the president was told that Flynn had lied to the vice president and had made similar statements to the FBI, the president invited FBI Director Comey to a private dinner at the White House and told Comey that he needed loyalty. On February 14th, the day after the president requested Flynn's resignation, the president told an outside advisor. Now that we fired Flynn, the Russia thing is over. The advisor disagreed and said the investigations would continue. Later that afternoon, the president cleared the Oval Office to have a one-on-one meeting with Comey. Referring to the FBI's investigation of Flynn, the president said, "I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go." Shortly after requesting Flynn's resignation and speaking privately to Comey, the president sought to have Deputy National Security Advisor K.T. McFarland draft an internal letter stating that the president had not directed Flynn to discuss sanctions with Kislyak. McFarland declined because she did not know whether that was true, and a White House counsel's office attorney thought that the request would look like a quid pro quo for an ambassadorship she had been offered. The president's reaction to the continuing Russia investigation. In February 2017, Attorney General Jeff Sessions began to assess whether he had to recuse himself from campaign-related investigations because of his role in the Trump campaign. In early March, the president told White House counsel Donald McGahn to stop Sessions from recusing. And after Sessions announced his recusal on March 2nd, the president expressed anger at the decision and told advisers that he should have an attorney general who would protect him. That weekend, the president took Sessions aside at an event and urged him to unrecuse. Later in March, Comey publicly disclosed at a congressional hearing that the FBI was investigating, quote, the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election, unquote, including any links or coordination between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. In the following days, the president reached out to the Director of National Intelligence and the leaders of the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, and the National Security Agency, NSA, to ask them what they could do to publicly dispel the suggestion that the president had any connection to the Russian election interference effort. The president also twice called Comey directly, notwithstanding guidance from McGahn to avoid direct contacts with the Department of Justice. Comey had previously assured the president that the FBI was not investigating him personally, and the president asked Comey to, quote, lift the cloud, unquote, of the Russia investigation by saying that publicly. The president's termination of Comey. On May 3, 2017, Comey testified in a congressional hearing but declined to answer questions about whether the president was personally under investigation. Within days, the president decided to terminate Comey. The president insisted that the termination letter, which was written for public release, state that Comey had informed the president that he was not under investigation. The day of the firing, the White House maintained that Comey's termination resulted from independent recommendations from the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General that Comey should be discharged for mishandling the Hillary Clinton email investigation. But the president had decided to fire Comey before hearing from the Department of Justice. The day after firing Comey, the president told Russian officials that he had, quote, faced great pressure because of Russia, unquote, which had been, quote, taken off, unquote, by Comey's firing. The next day, the president acknowledged in a television interview that he was going to fire Comey regardless of the Department of Justice's recommendation, and that when he, quote, decided to just do it, unquote, he was thinking that, quote, this thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story, unquote. In response to a question about whether he was angry with Comey about the Russia investigation, the president said, as far as I'm concerned, I want that thing to be absolutely done properly, adding that firing Comey might even lengthen out the investigation. The appointment of a special counsel and efforts to remove him. On May 17, 2017, the acting attorney general for the Russia investigation appointed a special counsel to conduct the investigation and related matters. The president reacted to news that a special counsel had been appointed by telling advisers that it was, quote, the end of his presidency, unquote, and demanding that Sessions resign. Sessions submitted his resignation, but the president ultimately did not accept it. The president told aides that the special counsel had conflicts of interest and suggested that the special counsel therefore could not serve. The president's advisers told him the asserted conflicts were meritless and had already been considered by the Department of Justice. On June 14, 2017, the media reported that the special counsel's office was investigating whether the president had obstructed justice. Press reports called this, quote, a major turning point, unquote, in the investigation. While Comey had told the president he was not under investigation, following Comey's firing, the president now was under investigation. The president reacted to this news with a series of tweets, criticizing the Department of Justice and the special counsel's investigation. On June 17, 2017, the president called McGahn at home and directed him to call the acting attorney general and say that the special counsel had conflicts of interest and must be removed. McGahn did not carry out the direction, however, deciding that he would resign rather than trigger what he regarded as a potential Saturday night massacre. Efforts to curtail the special counsel's investigation. 2 days after directing McGahn to have the special counsel removed, the president made another attempt to affect the course of the Russia investigation. On June 19, 2017, the president met one-on-one in the Oval Office with his former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, a trusted advisor outside the government, and dictated a message for Lewandowski to deliver to Sessions. The message said that Sessions should publicly announce that, notwithstanding his recusal from the Russia investigation, the investigation was, quote, very unfair, unquote, to the president. The president had done nothing wrong, and Sessions planned to meet with the special counsel and, quote, let him move forward with investigating election meddling for future elections. Lewandowski said he understood what the president wanted Sessions to do. 1 month later, in another private meeting with Lewandowski, on July 19, 2017, the president asked about the status of his message for Sessions to limit the special counsel investigation to future election interference. Lewandowski told the president that the message would be delivered soon. Hours after that meeting, the president publicly criticized Sessions in an interview with the New York Times, and then issued a series of tweets making it clear that Sessions' job was in jeopardy. Lewandowski did not want to deliver the president's message personally, so he asked senior White House official Rick Dearborn to deliver it to Sessions. Dearborn was uncomfortable with the task and did not follow through. Efforts to prevent public disclosure of evidence. In the summer of 2017, the president learned that media outlets were asking questions about the June 9, 2016 meeting at Trump Tower between senior campaign officials, including Donald Trump Jr., and a Russian lawyer who was said to be offering damaging information about Hillary Clinton as, quote, part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, unquote. On several occasions, the president directed aides not to publicly disclose the emails setting up the June 9th meeting, suggesting that the emails would not leak and that the number of lawyers with access to them should be limited. Before the emails became public, the president edited a press statement for Trump Jr. by deleting a line that acknowledged that the meeting was with, quote, an individual who Trump Jr. was told might have information helpful to the campaign, unquote, and instead said only that the meeting was about adoption of Russian children. When the press asked questions about the president's involvement in Trump Jr.'s statement, the president's personal lawyer repeatedly denied the president had played any role. Further efforts to have the Attorney General take control of the investigation. In early summer 2017, the president called Sessions at home and again asked him to reverse his recusal from the Russia investigation. Sessions did not reverse his recusal. In October 2017, the president met privately with Sessions in the Oval Office and asked him to, quote, take a look, unquote, at investigating Clinton. In December 2017, shortly after Flynn pleaded guilty pursuant to a cooperation agreement, the president met with Sessions in the Oval Office and suggested, according to notes taken by a senior advisor, that if Sessions unrecused and took back supervision of the Russia investigation, he would be a, quote, hero, unquote. The president told Sessions, I'm not going to do anything or direct you to do anything. I just want to be treated fairly. Sessions volunteered that he had never seen anything, quote, improper, unquote, on the campaign, and told the president there was a, quote, whole new leadership team, unquote, in place. He did not unrecuse. Efforts to have McGahn deny that the president had ordered him to have the special counsel removed. In early 2018, the press reported that the president had directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed in June 2017, and that McGahn had threatened to resign rather than carry out the order. The president reacted to the news stories by directing White House officials to tell McGahn to dispute the story and create a record stating he had not been ordered to have the special counsel removed. McGahn told those officials that the media reports were accurate in stating that the president had directed McGahn to have the special counsel removed. The president then met with McGahn in the Oval Office and again pressured him to deny the reports. In the same meeting, the president also asked McGahn why he had told the special counsel about the president's effort to remove the special counsel and why McGahn took notes of his conversations with the president. McGahn refused to back away from what he remembered happening and perceived the president to be testing his mettle. Conduct towards Flynn, Manafort. Redaction. Harm to ongoing matter. After Flynn withdrew from a joint defense agreement with the president and began cooperating with the government, the president's personal counsel left a message for Flynn's attorneys reminding them of the president's warm feelings towards Flynn, which he said, quote, still remains, unquote, and asking for a, quote, heads up, unquote, if Flynn knew, quote, information that implicates the president, unquote. When Flynn's counsel reiterated that Flynn could no longer share information pursuant to a joint defense agreement, the president's personal counsel said he would make sure that the president knew that Flynn's actions reflected, quote, hostility, unquote, towards the president. During Manafort's prosecution, and when the jury in his criminal trial was deliberating, the president praised Manafort in public, said that Manafort was being treated unfairly, and declined to rule out a pardon. After Manafort was convicted, the president called Manafort, quote, a brave man, unquote, for refusing to, quote, break, unquote, and said that, quote, flipping, unquote, quote, almost ought to be outlawed, unquote. Redaction. Harm to ongoing matter. Conduct involving Michael Cohen. The president's conduct toward Michael Cohen, a former Trump Organization executive, changed from praise for Cohen when he falsely minimized the president's involvement in the Trump Tower Moscow project, to castigation of Cohen when he became a cooperating witness. From September 2015 to June 2016, Cohen had pursued the Trump Tower Moscow project on behalf of the Trump Organization and had briefed candidate Trump on the project numerous times, including discussing whether Trump should travel to Russia to advance the deal. In 2017, Cohen provided false testimony to Congress about the project, including stating that he had only briefed Trump on the project 3 times and never discussed travel to Russia with him in an effort to adhere to a, quote, party line, unquote, that Cohen said was developed to minimize the president's connections to Russia. While preparing for his congressional testimony, Cohen had extensive discussions with the president's personal counsel, who, according to Cohen, said that Cohen should, quote, stay on message, unquote, and not contradict the president. After the FBI searched Cohen's home and office in April 2018, the president publicly asserted that Cohen would not, quote, flip, unquote, contacted him directly to tell him to, quote, stay strong, unquote, and privately passed messages of support to him. Cohen also discussed pardons with the president's personal counsel and believed that if he stayed on message, he would be taken care of. But after Cohen began cooperating with the government in the summer of 2018, the president publicly criticized him, called him a, quote, rat, unquote, and suggested that his family members had committed crimes. Overarching factual issues. We did not make a traditional prosecution decision about these facts, but the evidence we obtained supports several general statements about the president's conduct. Several features of the conduct we investigated distinguish it from typical obstruction of justice cases. First, the investigation concerned the president, and some of his actions, such as firing the FBI director, involved facially lawful acts within his Article II authority, which raises constitutional issues discussed below. At the same time, the president's position as the head of the executive branch provided him with unique and powerful means of influencing official proceedings, subordinate officers, and potential witnesses, all of which is relevant to a potential obstruction of justice analysis. Second, unlike cases in which a subject engages in obstruction of justice to cover